From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk about movies with Stephen Frears, director of My Beautiful Laundrette, Dangerous Liaisons, and the new movie The Grifters, starring Angelica Houston and John Cusack. Also today, we talk with photographer Sylvia Plahi about her early life in Hungary and about her photographs of New York life for The Village Voice. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Wrong Way Up, the new album of songs by Brian Eno and John Cale. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the film event of the holiday season, Godfather 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein called today for dialogue with the U.S. on the Gulf crisis, but he again insisted on including other Middle Eastern issues on the agenda. The BBC's John Simpson reports from Baghdad.
President Saddam Hussein is letting it be known that if the Americans are prepared to talk, he is too. He told a group of Iraqi ambassadors, temporarily recalled here for consultations, that he was prepared for serious and constructive dialogue, but that Iraq wouldn't kneel to the Americans. But as always, he linked any negotiations on the Gulf crisis with efforts to solve the Palestinian question, something Washington has specifically refused to consider. Nevertheless, the complete silence which the two sides have maintained towards each other does seem to have come to an end, though whether the tentative contacts will actually get anywhere is hard to say. The American embassy here says there's been no actual face-to-face meeting.
The BBC's John Simpson in Baghdad. Economists based in the Middle East say that Saudi Arabia's costs in the Persian Gulf crisis have far outrun the profits it's making from high-priced oil. The Saudis are estimated to have earned as much as an extra $18 billion in oil revenue this year. That's in addition to the $31 billion they were expecting to make. Analysts say, however, that the Saudis have spent or pledged about $30 billion in connection with the Gulf crisis. The kingdom is paying the food, fuel, and housing costs for the troops of the multinational force, as well as most of the aid to the frontline states. Today, San Francisco Mayor Art Agnew signed landmark worker safety legislation to protect an estimated 50,000 workers who use video display terminals, or VDTs. Maya Krejci of member station KQED has more.
The new ordinance mandates that businesses upgrade lighting, equipment, and furniture for employees who spend most of their time working at computer terminals. It also calls for periodic work breaks. The object is to reduce disabling repetitive motion illness and vision problems that plague VDT users. San Francisco Mayor Art Agnew.
It is the worker safety issue in the 1990s. And San Francisco is the first major city in America to successfully address and pass this issue in a comprehensive and thoughtful way.
Bitter local business opposition to the VDT measure has already prompted amendments to the new law. In its final form, the ordinance will give private and public sector employers 4 years to comply with the new standards. For National Public Radio, this is Maya Krejci in San Francisco.
Trading on Wall Street got off to a late start today, delayed by a transformer fire in New York's financial district. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points to close at 2,625.5. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in light trading of 102 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Grifters is the first film British director Stephen Frears has made in America. Vincent Canby wrote in the New York Times that Frears has made a smashing variation on the sort of movie that people mean when they ask why Hollywood doesn't make movies the way they used to. The Grifters is adapted from a pulp novel written in 1963 by Jim Thompson. It's the story of three con artists, Lily, her son Roy, and his girlfriend Myra. The film stars Angelica Houston, John Cusack, and Annette Bening. Stephen Frears first became known in the U.S. with a film about a young gay Pakistani man in England who runs a laundromat. The film was called My Beautiful Laundrette. The story and screenplay were written by the British-Pakistani writer Hanif Qureshi. Frears and Qureshi also collaborated on the film Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. These films led a new trend in British cinema in the mid-80s that broke away from the masterpiece theater version of Britain to show the working class, multicultural life. Frears also directed Prick Up Your Ears and Dangerous Liaisons. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Stephen Frears about his new film, The Grifters.
How did you end up making The Grifters? Was this your idea? Were you a Jim Thompson fan, or did someone offer you the project?
No, I was offered it as a book by Martin Scorsese, a man I admire more than I can say. And I liked the story, and I understood it, and I think I thought that I was looking to make a film in America, and people used to send me things, and I'd say, well, I'm sure this is very good, but I don't actually understand what it's about. And I think that a book in that sort of hard-boiled style made sense to me.
When you say you understood it...
Well, I understand about cheap paperbacks, and I like all that sort of pulp fiction. And I understood that, you know, that was a way in which you told rather strong stories. I mean, so I responded to that. And it gave me access to American culture, which a more conventional script perhaps wouldn't have done.
It is very much an American story. It's
very much so. Yes.
Con artists, and they spend a lot of time at the racetrack and in bars. Did you have to do any kind of research to learn?
Yes,
about
Yes, I don't
that
know. I don't know anything about. Well, I don't know. I know nothing about America. I don't know anything about horse racing. I don't know what that world is like. I had to learn about it. I knew what it was like from the movies, but in real life, I had to learn about it. But people take that stuff. You can learn. You know, you can. People will take you to places and show you how to do certain kinds of tricks and things like that. That's available. Of course, the emotion, the relationships between the characters. You know, that comes from somewhere else.
Well, what did you do to prepare? Did you get people to take you to the
race? I mean, con men would come in and show me their tricks.
Really?
Yeah, they were rather nice people, and it was always very funny, and they'd show you how they cheated people.
Who found the con men?
Well, you never know, but I know somebody who knows somebody, and I don't know. You know, I'm a film director. I'm somehow shielded from all of that. But if you ask to meet a grifter, they'll find one for you.
So what were some of the things they showed you?
Oh, the magnets up sleeves and, palming cards and three-card Monte, all that sort of stuff. And also that it's all on a very, very, it's for $10. It's not for $100,000. That's big. That's sort of something else. This is just for $10. Mm-hmm. Really, the truth is we're all suckers and we haven't a hope. I know I'm a sucker. I can't live in... I couldn't live with those guys. They could take my money any day.
Did they?
How do I know? That's part of the joy. You never know that you've been done.
Since the characters in this film, they are con artists, and part of the con is that you can't let other people really read your face.
Yes, of course.
And they're very tight-lipped, and they really can't reveal their true selves on the outside. So is it hard to get the actors to reveal their inner motivations to the audience since they're trying to hide it from the other characters in the film? Is it hard to direct a performance like that?
I think I do that instinctively. The last film I made, Dangerous Liaisons, that was quite a problem. That's to say, whenever anybody spoke, they were always lying, and eventually we found a way that you could actually see the dishonesty and the layers of deceit. It didn't so explicitly... It didn't present itself as a problem in the same way in this film. No, I mean, that's... Somehow it was about the fact that you didn't know whether somebody was lying or not, and only afterwards did you discover, I see, they weren't saying what they meant at all.
Your films, all the ones that I've seen, have some very serious and sometimes very brutal scenes in them, but then suddenly they'll shift to something that's really quite funny that has jaunty music in the background.
Yeah.
Is that an important element for you, and what are you trying to say with that?
Well, I don't like the nasty bits, if that's what you mean. I mean, sort of slightly shut my eyes. I hate doing them. It seems to be part of life. They're never, those days aren't much fun. I like it when it's all cheerful. But the films seem to be about people who find life quite difficult. I mean, which includes me, and I imagine most people in the world. And it has a sense of people's struggle to get through life. But people are also very, very cheerful about it and laugh a lot and make light of quite difficult things.
Would you ever be drawn to doing a more fantasy kind of film, though, that's not so realistic?
What about going to the moon? I'd love to. I'm not sure how well I'd do it. I come from a... My training in Britain was to make films which recorded what life was like. And then, you know, then turn them into fiction and make stories out of them, but nevertheless, that life was somehow the basis of it.
Well, my guest is film director Stephen Frears, and his new film is The Grifters. It's based on a novel by Jim Thompson and stars Angelica Houston and John Cusack. Dangerous Liaisons was your first major Hollywood studio production.
Yes.
Right? And before that, the films that you were known for over here were My Beautiful Laundrette and Prick Up Your Ears and Sammy and Rosie Get Laid.
That's right.
And all of those were about class and race and homosexuality.
Yes.
And they were set in these rather netherworlds of London.
Yeah.
So you would seem to have been the least likely choice to direct this major studio production about the French aristocracy in the 18th century.
Yes, that's right.
How did you get that job?
Well, it took them a long time to come to me, though the writer, Christopher Hampton, who was also the producer, he said right from the beginning, the person you want is Stephen Frears. And they said, no, he makes those films, you know, about other subjects. But of course he was right, because really what I'm used to is working with very, very good writers. And Liaison was a wonderful script, and I knew Christopher very well, and I understood absolutely what he was writing about. So it wasn't difficult for me. I wasn't surprised, but I could see other people were.
I read that, Milos Forman was doing the same story, or he was doing
Valmont
at the same time, and I read that every other director they spoke with had turned down the project because they didn't want to go up against Milos Forman.
Well, I had nothing to lose. Since I had no reputation, it was pretty... I mean, I wasn't in a threatened position.
What did it mean for you as the director of that film to know that Milos Forman was doing Valmont at the same time?
Well, at first it was rather scary, and I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, I'll make such a fool of myself. The script was very, very good. I mean, that's really what it came down to. The script of Liaison was so good that you always felt confident in that. And then, you know, I come from a world of cheap films. I make films very quickly because we don't have the sort of resources to take a long time. So I sort of knew if it came to a race, I would probably be faster.
So how long did it take you?
Liaison?
Uh-huh.
I was hired at the end of January and the film opened in December. I mean, it was thought to be very, very quick.
Uh-huh.
But for me, it was longer than I'd ever spent on a film.
How long did it take Milos Forman?
Oh, my goodness. He started shooting after I finished shooting. And he then came out a year later. So, yes, it took him, 15 to 18 months. In fact, it must have taken him best part of 2 years.
It's Dangerous Liaisons. It's a period piece from the 18th century, and you could have gone the route of doing, making it really opulent with large crowds and a lot of chateaus.
Yes, that was what I didn't want to do.
Why didn't you want to do that?
Well, because I've seen films like that, and they don't interest me. And what I always liked about the script was that it wasn't about that. It was just about these people and how they interacted and how they revolved around each other and fell in love with each other or whatever. And that the story was absolutely wonderful, and that if you did put in a lot of sort of French 18th century period detail, that was somehow not very interesting. And I remember saying to the costume designer and to the set designer, both of whom were wonderfully talented men, I said, look, if people come out talking about the costumes, we've sort of failed. You know, it's the story which is so wonderful.
And you ended up using a lot of close-up shots on the
Well,
faces.
That's what you were talking about. That's because if you went in close, you saw that they were saying one thing and meaning another. It's simply, it's a quite practical problem. How do you show dishonesty, or how do you show that someone doesn't mean what they say? And there are several answers. There are several, you know, there's no limit to the number of ways you can do that. But in that film, what worked was going in and seeing their eyes.
Well, let's take a short break right now. My guest is film director Stephen Frears. His films include My Beautiful Laundrette, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, Prick Up Your Ears, and Dangerous Liaisons. His new film is The Grifters. It's from a Jim Thompson novel, and it stars Angelica Houston and John Cusack. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Frears is my guest. A few years ago, you directed Prick Up Your Ears, mm-hmm. and that was about the British playwright Joe Orton mm-hmm. and his homosexual relationship with Kenneth Halliwell. And Halliwell ended up bludgeoning Orton to death, and this all happened in the late yes. 60s in London. And that was a project that you actually had first tried to do back in 1981, and yes. it didn't happen, but you really persisted with it. What was it about his story that you really... made you really want to produce that film?
Well, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I imagine there were all the way through it, there were themes that interested me, and it was a very, very good script. I mean, they don't float around. When you find one, you're really pleased. I mean, we didn't make it in the early 80s because, you know, the climate shifted slightly in the mid-80s, and we were able to, I think now you couldn't make it. But at that time, we were good, and we were able to get the money, and we went back and did more work on the script. So it was sort of, opportune. And we couldn't find an actor the first time, and then in the meantime, Gary Oldman, who says that he did come to see me in 1980, but he was growing up a bit, so that when we saw him again in 1986, he was that much older and, you know, had filled out and become a man of the right age.
Did you just say now you couldn't make that film?
I doubt if you could make that film now.
Why is that?
Because the legislation in Britain has become more repressive. And I don't think you could... You know, it was quite an expensive film because we had to recreate an earlier period. And I don't think you could go to somebody and sort of honourably ask them to invest in the film now. It would seem to me that the forces lined up against it were too strong. I mean, there's legislation which, you know, although no one, perhaps you wouldn't get prosecuted, you'd always be nervous that you were going to be prosecuted.
What legislation?
Oh, there's a clause in some bill which makes it illegal to promote homosexuality. Well, I don't know what the words mean even, but, you know, someone might say, oh, this is promoting homosexuality, let's take them to court. And cause havoc that way. So, you know, the whole climate is against that sort of work.
I believe there are some similarities between you and Joe Orton. You both grew up in Leicester around the same time.
You made me very nervous when you said that.
Well, he just
was
some.
Yes, he was older than I was, but I certainly came from the same town as him. Yes.
And did you enjoy putting in a lot of references to Leicester in the film?
Yes, I suppose so. Oh, it was a terrible place. It was a terrible place after the war. I mean, Britain was a difficult place after the war. There was such austerity and hardship. But Leicester was always a very narrow-minded town. And the truth is, you couldn't wait to get out of it. And he got out, and I got out.
Is it true? I think one of the characters in Prick Up Your Ears mentions that Sir Richard Attenborough came from Leicester.
I then met him and challenged him on this, and he said, well, he didn't really... He went to school in Leicester, and when I was a child, he was sort of held up as this model schoolboy, and my life was made a misery because I wasn't in his league, you know. He was what well-behaved children were supposed to be. but he said that he really came from Cambridge, and his father, in fact, was there. He was the vice-chancellor of the university in Leicester. And he was actually rather nice.
I actually heard another story. He wanted to appear and prick up your ears.
That's right. I said to him, oh, I'm from Leicester. You destroyed my childhood. You ruined my childhood simply by inadvertently. He said, oh, I'll come and play a man in a lavatory.
And there's scenes of gay men picking up men in the lavatories.
That's right.
That was in London, right?
That was in London, yes. It was always based on the research. There was a book published. A man did research into this in some American city. It was an extraordinary book written in very, very academic language about these extraordinary practices with sort of diagrams of where people would stand on the floor. It was incredibly funny that a man had sat there making these notes.
Is this a sociologist?
A sociologist, exactly, exactly.
Did you use that to research, or
I made it up. I had no idea. I have no idea what goes on in public laboratories.
You studied law at Trinity University?
Trinity College,
Trinity
Cambridge.
College. Mm. How did you end up working in film?
Well, it was very, very boring reading law. I mean, really dull. And while I was at Cambridge, I worked in the theatre a lot, and I thought that I wanted to work in the theatre for a living. And I got jobs in theatres, and then I found it not... like I wasn't as happy as I would have hoped. And then I met a film director who said, come and work on my film. So I went and worked on his film in complete bewilderment about what was going on. And then I made a film. And then what happens in life is you discover that people will employ you and actually, you know, pay you a wage to make a film. And so I learnt, as it were, as I went along. And then you one day think, oh, I see, I can actually make these films. Now perhaps I should think about what I make, why I photograph that and not that. And so it was a complete accident, really.
Uh-huh. Who was the film director?
Carol Rice.
And wasn't he part of, in France around this time in the 60s, there
in
was...
In Britain.
Well, in France, there was the New Wave,
yes.
You know, cinema,
yes,
the New
I
Wave. Was there a comparable thing going
yes,
on?
There was yes, absolutely. I mean, he and a man called Lindsay Anderson and Tony Richardson, they sort of changed the whole thing. And, you know, those sort of rather old-fashioned films about the British stiff upper lip and the middle classes stopped being made and they started making films about ordinary people and ordinary lives, ordinary social problems, working-class people. And television really picked up from them and started showing life in Britain as it really is. I mean, you know, ordinary life, ordinary regular life, not that sort of view, you know, as though life sort of came down from the Queen in some way, not that sort of official tourist view of Britain. Just the real thing.
Did you want to work in film?
Well, when I came down from university, I wanted to work for the BBC. Around the time, at the end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s, it suddenly became a place where there were large numbers of young people who sort of had nowhere to go, very, very highly educated, intelligent people who wanted to find some means of expression, and the BBC became where they went to. And fellows at university when I was there, they were all getting jobs in the BBC. So the brightest people in the country went to this institution and they sort of took it over. A few years later, it was the Beatles and, you know, things like that. But at that time, the BBC became, largely when it was run by Graham Greene's brother, it became a place where the very, very bright, energetic, lively people were to be found. And it was the most wonderful place where you were trained to sort of question the system and trained to show life as it really was and trained to be sceptical about official versions of things. It was a wonderful place and a wonderful training ground. I went through, you know, a period of 10 years just making film after film, not comparable to anything that's in America except maybe sort of independent films and all... Because it was a subsidised system, all they wanted was a good film. And I was working with the best writers in England, the best actors in England. It was a fantastic training ground.
What were some of the films that you made for TV, or some of the shows that you made for TV while you were working?
They were a lot of sort of 70-minute films by very, very good writers. I doubt if you wouldn't know what they were. I mean, they weren't things that were shown in this country, although I think the museums showed quite a few of them. But they were done by the best. You know, I worked with Tom Stoppard and people like that, Alan Bennett, a lot. They were where they were writing for. Because you couldn't get into films. Films was a sort of closed world. So young people, people of my age, just took this medium over.
You did make Gumshoe. How did that come about? But then you didn't make another film.
Well, I made that because it's a very, very good script that a friend of mine wrote, and we got Albert to be in it, Albert Finney to be in it. So it was, we got given the money, but I didn't really know what I was doing. Then I went into television. And what I was really doing, although I didn't know this at the time, was finding a place where I could learn my job.
And then My Beautiful Laundrette, which was your next film, actually started out as a TV show, and you...
Well, when I was sent the script of My Beautiful Laundrette, I said, this is very, very good. This is like these television films we've been making, so we shouldn't try to kid ourselves that this is for the cinema. So it went into the cinema by popular demand. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, you know... We weren't thinking. Oh, this really would be good if it was in the cinema. It was suddenly started being shown in New York and in Paris, and it was a complete eye opener to us. We were all astonished.
For that film, also, you were known for presenting homosexuality in a very humanizing kind of way, because
yes.
I think it was one of the first films that had a homosexual relationship in it, but it really wasn't about homosexuality.
Well, it didn't show them to be sort of that it was a problem in any way.
It just came out very naturally.
Yes, yes.
Did you and Hanif Qureshi, who wrote the screenplay, did you discuss how you wanted to present that relationship?
I don't think I ever had a conversation with him. It just evolved naturally. I mean, the homosexuality was in the script, and I remember because it was a radical film. I remember being delighted that you had to be radical on all levels, which included relationships and sexual relationships. And then I discovered afterwards that I'd shot it like a sort of high school picture, and that it was really my memory of American teen films from the 50s. Sort of people necking in open cars and things like that. Boys and girls in the American films. And in fact, without thinking about it, I'd subverted it and made it a sort of parody of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly true that it somehow was acceptable, and I always liked it that it didn't treat homosexuality as if it was some terrible disease.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time. Do you know what your next project's going to be?
No, I have to go and get a job. Why do you laugh?
Just the way you put it sounds funny.
Well, I haven't got a job and I want to get one. but I notice people laugh when I say that.
Well, thanks a lot for coming by today and doing the interview.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.
Director Stephen Frears spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. Frears' new film, The Grifters, will open nationally on January 25th. Next time, guitarist Steve Cropper. He played in the house band at the Stax Studio in Memphis in the early 60s. He co-wrote and produced many of Otis Redding's songs and played in the band Booker T and the MGs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Photographer Sylvia Plahi fled her native Hungary when she was just a teenager. She settled in New York, and for the past decade, her photos have appeared in the Village Voice. Coming up, Sylvia Plahi tells us how, years later, she got a second chance to photograph the Hungarian Revolution. Brian Eno and John Cale have been mainstays in rock's avant-garde. Now they've collaborated on a new album. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Godfather 3. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In the Soviet Union, the new vice president is Gennady Anayev, who had been turned down earlier today by the Congress of People's Deputies. The Congress reversed that decision after a personal appeal from Soviet President Gorbachev. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev told the Congress he wanted a vice president he could trust, and that person was Yanayev, a cautious, little-known man picked from the top ranks of the Communist Party. Gorbachev's personal appeal turned enough votes to win election for Yanayev the second time the Congress voted. Gorbachev and his new vice president face an immediate crisis caused by Russia's refusal to pay its share of the national budget. Russia is the largest and wealthiest of the Soviet republics and the biggest contributor to the Soviet budget. The Russian parliament says it wants to control its own finances, but Gorbachev warned today that if the budget rebellion continues, the entire Soviet economy and the country will collapse. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
President Bush says not to believe reports that U.S. forces are not yet ready to fight in the Persian Gulf. Mr. Bush, at the White House for a few hours, breaking from his vacation at Camp David, said today that he was very comfortable with the state of the massive U.S. troop deployment in the Persian Gulf. There is a U.N. deadline of January 15th for Iraq to get out of Kuwait. The president also said that there has been no progress in efforts for high-level talks between the U.S. and Iraq. There have been news reports that the Secretary of Defense and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have told the president about concerns of U.S. military officers about the readiness of U.S. troops in the Gulf. The snow that's been falling over most of the Midwest all day is now moving to the east. Winter weather advisories remain in effect for portions of Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky. From St. Louis, Kathy Lohr reports.
3 to 9 inches of snow fell across Missouri and parts of Illinois today. Light snow in eastern Missouri is expected to end and move northeast throughout the night. According to the National Weather Service, central and southern Illinois, parts of Indiana, and southern Michigan will see snow tonight and tomorrow. Northern Kentucky is likely to get snow mixed with sleet. Warmer temperatures will bring rain to the southern half of Kentucky, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. Following the snow and sleet, the area should get a break for a few days, but another Arctic front is on its way. It's expected to bring more snow and rain and below zero temperatures by Monday. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 12 points to close at 2,625.50 on volume of some 102 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Cale and Brian Eno have collaborated on a new album called Wrong Way Up. Cale was a member of the Velvet Underground in the late 60s and early 70s. Last year, he worked with his former Velvet cohort Lou Reed on songs for Drella, a tribute to Andy Warhol. Eno was a founding member of Roxy Music, had a successful solo career in the mid-70s, and produced albums for many groups, including the Talking Heads. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Wrong Way Up. It's the first album Eno has sung on since 1978.
For a couple of guys with avant-garde reputations, Brian Eno and John Cale have made an awfully catchy little album with Wrong Way Up. This collection of pretty melodies and soothing vocals is a complete departure from the work these musicians have been making for the past 10 or 15 years. Eno has spent the last decade in degrees of silence, either making morose mood music without vocals or not recording at all. Cale is the classically trained violist with a big Welsh roar of a voice, and he did his best bellowing in the 70s on rampaging rave-ups with titles like Fear, Guts, and Sabotage. So the gentleness of spirit that's on display on Wrong Way Up is at first startling and then deeply pleasurable. So they rode the sea. That's Empty Frame. Brian Eno's lulling monotone glides across layers of keyboard tracks, piano, organ, synthesizer, as well as gently pulsing guitars and bass. The melody is pure pop, but no pop song that ever aspired to real popularity would contain a couplet like, "We pushed the empty frame of reason out the cabin door. No, we won't be needing reason anymore." There's a dreamy surrealism that suffuses the music on this album, but at its best, that dreaminess is urgent, not schlocky. Nighttime is falling on the moon. It's been a lazy afternoon. We walk to the house, the air is clear. The water's That's One Word, a composition that would not sound at all out of place on a rock radio station, either as a hit single or the music for a jeans commercial. To hear these arty fellows drop the formal reserve that has characterized so much of their previous work is very funny, even if, as in the case of Crime in the Desert, the result nearly tips over into self-parody. Wrong Way Up is such a charming collection, it doesn't even spoil it to think of the album as a deeply cynical record, an attempt by Eno and Cale to make Muzak out of their earlier, more difficult work. In fact, it enhances my enjoyment to think of Eno and Cale as the Milli Vanilli of art rock. This is the kind of crassness more intelligent musicians should strive for, since it results in a directness that still remains mysterious and beguiling.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Strong.
This is Fresh Air. That's music by Tom Waits, recorded on a plastic flexi-disc found in a new book of photographs by Sylvia Plahy. Waits composed the music at Plahy's request to accompany her book Unguided Tour. Plahy is a staff photographer for the Village Voice, where she has a weekly photo feature that is also called Unguided Tour. That feature showcases her pictures of people and scenes she runs into on the streets of New York. But she also goes on assignment to take pictures for stories by reporters for The Voice and other magazines. Her book includes her street photos, as well as portraits of well-known people such as composer Virgil Thompson, the German director Rainer Werner Fassbinder, writer William Burroughs, and musician Tom Waits. I asked her how she goes about taking these portraits.
I try to know as much about them as possible, so I have an idea who they are, and I usually have an hour or less than an hour to spend with them. And I just try to see something that's clicks as a truth about them.
Well, let me give an example. You have a picture of the late actor and writer Charles Ludlam. Now, he was the founder of the Ridiculous Theater Company.
Right.
They used to do very funny, campy send-ups of classics. Like, he had a fabulous production of Camille, in which he starred in the title role in drag. And you show him backstage putting on his fake bosoms.
Mm-hmm.
And he has one hand glamorously fluffing his hair, but of course he's bald, you know. So he's like fluffing his bald head. What was the inspiration for that shot?
Well, I was there, and I was backstage photographing, and he was just camping it up for me.
Mm-hmm.
I love to photograph backstage. I think it's much more interesting than being up front and watching the play.
Why is that?
It's just I'm more interested in the seams of things and when they are not quite finished or perfect, but how it's put together and to feel, to sense the emotions that go on back there.
Often your photographs are of people you've just run into on the street. Is there a kind of street etiquette when you want to take the photo of someone who you don't know?
Yes, it's somewhat awkward all the time, which is the drawback of being a photographer. I usually kind of ask and take the picture at the same time, because if you ask, people will pose and change whatever they are doing. So if you manage to evolve into a kind of a gesture or discover a gesture that will sort of ask, and then people will forgive you and let you take the picture. Usually most people don't mind.
Now, I know you grew up in Hungary. When and why did you leave?
We left in 1956, after the Hungarian Revolution. My parents decided that they were not ready to go through another wave of repression. And so pretty much at the end of the time when people could leave, we left. We had to still escape. And by then, they were putting up mines again at the border, and there were border guards there who were shooting up flares. And so we had to walk, I think, something like 5 miles to the Austrian border and escape that way.
How old were you?
I was 13.
How vivid are your memories?
They're probably more vivid of that time than things that happened yesterday. I remember pretty much, I remember a lot of things from my childhood because it was so abruptly ended. So I hung on to it and probably spend obsessed over it more than most children as they go into adolescence and adulthood.
Did you have photographs of, you know, from your life in Hungary when you emigrated?
I didn't have too many photographs, and I had to, and I didn't take pictures then. I got my first camera in Austria from, my father bought me an Agfa box camera, with which I took my first pictures. And but before that, I didn't. And I've always regretted that I wasn't a photographer when the revolution took place, because I was there when they pulled down the statue of Stalin in this big square, and we were all singing the national anthem. So all those events, and I saw dead bodies on the street covered with lime, I saw the tanks roaming in, and I saw the people being so excited, and it was all vividly in my mind, but I never could take a picture of it. And then this past year, when all these things have changed in Eastern Europe, I've been back several times this year, and from the middle of last year, and I was there one time with a writer from the Village Voice, James Ridgway, and we were walking around. And I was showing him where I was born and where everything happened. And we walked up to the square where the statue of Stalin was pulled down, and it was there. They were filming a movie about the 56th Revolution, and they had a copy. A papier-mâché copy of the statue of Stalin, and they had all these extras in 1956, costumes, and singing the national anthem, and it was like they produced it for me. It was a wonderful thing to have my second chance and see my life as a movie.
So did you photograph it?
Of course. I was totally overexcited about it. But
was it difficult for you to find a place for yourself professionally when you started to try to make a living as a photographer?
Yes, it was very difficult at first, because I had to make a living, and it's difficult to break in and do work as in something that you love. So I had to have other jobs somewhere, and it took me a long time to have the courage to go around, to show my work, and to also, while I was doing my regular job, which was working at the Girl Scouts of the USA doing statistics, I used up pretty much all my energy. And when I would go out at night, I did not have any more creative juices left, and I would never see any pictures. Now the problem seems to be more like the opposite of seeing too many things and just not having the energy to take it all.
Now I want to ask you about another photograph.
Mm-hmm.
You have a picture of a shack under the Williamsburg Bridge in Brooklyn, and written in graffiti on the shack is AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
How did you stumble on the shack?
Yes. I was there.
It's not very safe to be walking under the bridges in New York. What were you doing there?
Well, I wasn't walking. I was fortunately in my car. I was driving around. I believe I was with Guy Trebe, with whom we have done a lot of stories for the Village Voice, and we were doing a story on Greenpoint and Williamsburg. And so we were driving around and probably looking to see if we could find some prostitutes. But as we were driving under the bridge, I saw this, and I got out and had my tripod, fortunately, with me, and took this picture. Because it was... It just was such an ominous image. It also reminded me of a Star of David or something that they used to paint on buildings in the wartime, things like that. It had an ominous quality about it.
So somehow this signified to you that someone had written that, implying that the person who lived inside had AIDS.
It felt like it,
mm-hmm.
But I have no idea whether they did or not. The building looked a little frightening and disturbing.
So I see sometimes when you take a photo, you build a narrative in your head about what the story might be about, even when you don't really know what it is.
I guess it's just thinking about what it might be. Something that you see leads you to remember something that you've seen before. And then it's connecting those things.
Photographer Sylvia Plahi, she's a staff photographer for the Village Voice. Her new collection of photos is called Unguided Tour. It's published by Aperture. Well, here's more of the Tom Waits plastic flexi disc included with the book. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, I'm sure you have the story on the new vice president of the Soviet Union.
You bet, Terry. Mikhail Gorbachev has used power politics today to assure the election of Gennady Yanayev as his new vice president. We'll have a discussion of the spread of AIDS in the Soviet Union, largely due, it is said, to a lack of sterile needles in that country. A report from the Kashmir section of India and the conflict there between the Muslim majority and the Hindu minority, and should Kashmir be part of Pakistan, India, or become independent. Also, we'll talk about the importance of stories to a culture with author Barry Lopez.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's the sequel that's been awaited even by people who don't like sequels. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
16 years after the hardest act to follow in recent movie history, the Godfather saga has returned. And if Part 3 isn't entirely up to snuff, it's still better than anything Francis Coppola has done since the last installment. The new movie is set in 1979, but it has a curiously 90s feel. It's about going straight and trying to be redeemed. Like the audiences that will probably gobble it up this winter, the movie's hero, Al Pacino's Michael Corleone, regrets the excesses of the past. Now he wants to do good, give to charity, heal the wounds his life of crime has inflicted. If that doesn't sound as sexy as the first two films' Romance of Evil, well, it isn't quite. This is a more meditative, valedictory work. And though there's plenty of violent action in it, the movie feels a lot softer. That's partly because the great theme of the first two movies was the relationship between fathers and sons, a relationship that by its very nature can evoke ambition, competition, violence. The Godfather Part 3 is about a father and his daughter, and that's a relationship more likely to evoke protectiveness and the pursuit of virtue. And so we meet a new Michael Corleone, his voice scarred by years of giving orders, his hair white and spiky, and a little creepy, like Leland Palmer's in Twin Peaks. What he wants now is to go legit, and he thinks he can do it by joining up with the most virtuous enterprise he can imagine, the Vatican. Here he is with his lawyer, played by George Hamilton, confronting the Vatican Bank's head archbishop, played by Donald Donnelly.
Corleone is it prepared to deposit $500 million in the Vatican Bank at such time as Mr. Corleone receives majority control of Immobiliare.
Immobiliare could be something new. A European conglomerate. Few families have control of such a company.
It seems in today's world, the power to absolve debt is greater than the power of forgiveness. $600 million.
Don't overestimate the power of forgiveness.
Of course, the Vatican Bank was not the repository of sweetness and light it may have seemed, and Michael's pursuit of redemption only leads him into a more tangled web of corruption, all of which is deftly spun out in the complex but crystal-clear screenplay by Coppola and Mario Puzo. Other things don't work so well. Michael has a nephew, Vincent, who emerges as his spiritual heir, and Andy Garcia plays him with his usual mesmerizing energy, but Vincent's private war with a John Gotti-like thug, played by Joe Mantegna, is hurt by Mantegna's oddly low wattage. Worse still, Vincent is supposed to fall for Michael's innocent daughter, played by Coppola's own young daughter, Sophia. This, as you may have heard, turns out to be the casting blunder of the year, because Sophia, brave though she may be, is neither an actress nor an attractive enough screen presence to make us believe the long, liquid looks Garcia keeps bestowing on her. And yet, in the end, the good stuff is all there. The dark deeds in darkened rooms, the set pieces of gorgeously staged violence, and the richly haunting performance of Al Pacino, who gives Michael a Shakespearean intensity and grandeur. No, it's not quite up to snuff. But even an imperfect Godfather looks better than just about anything else on this year's Christmas list.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He co-wrote the hit Soul Man and In the Midnight Hour, and played with Booker T and the MGs and the house band for Stax Records. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with guitarist Steve Cropper. Also, David Brenner on Life as a Stand-Up Comic, and world music critic Milo Miles on Zook. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.